We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right, lots to cover today, so let's just dive in, starting with local and Mayor Mike McGinn has a proposal for the Seattle Police Department.
Yes. He announced that he had a proposal to fix the Seattle Police Department. It's called 2020, A Vision for the Future. And in order to come up with enough items on this 2020 proposal, in other words, 20 items, clearly it was all sort of designed to fit in with this sort of marketing idea.
It is a marketing idea.
Yeah, you read through the 20 proposals, and there are about four of them maybe that sound like, yes, that's a good idea to do that. The others, you read them and you go, what does this mean?
I'm holding in my hand a list of all 20 of them, and every single one of them, as near as I can tell, fits into one of four categories. And I have those four categories, and there's a little bit of overlap here too. Those four categories are, hey, good idea, slaps forehead. You mean they've never done this before? You want to give any details? Any at all? Like, is this for better or for worse? And then, what the hell is this supposed to mean?
Yeah.
They're all like that. So for instance, we have addressed biased policing, which falls into both, hey, good idea, and...
You mean you've never done this before?
And also...
and also...
you want to give any details? Any details at all?
Yeah. What do they mean exactly by biased?
Yeah, exactly. So we have train all officers on use of force standards consistent with Seattle's values. What the hell?
I know.
What are Seattle's values?
What do you mean by Seattle's values? You know, I read that and I thought, why not just train them to follow the law?
Similarly,
train them to understand what's constitutionally required of them.
Or how about train them to not gratuitously beat the crap out of people or shoot them?
Yeah, be a little more specific.
Yeah, similarly, we have train new officers to understand Seattle.
Yeah, I read that one and I just was like, oh, please.
And,
come on.
And here's a favorite. Recruit great officers.
Yeah, that falls into the category of you haven't been doing this.
Also, hey, good idea.
Yeah, good idea. But it's definitely a marketing push. And what really struck me after I read all the 20 items was how almost none of them, in fact, I didn't think any of them really addressed the core issues that brought about the Department of Justice investigation.
Don't.
Community groups that contacted the Department of Justice and requested they come in and do an investigation of the Seattle Police Department basically were saying, you know, the SPD is violating the civil rights of minority suspects. And there's nothing in this proposal that McGinn made that even mentions that, much less addresses that issue. The biased policing, sure, but that was so vague that it just makes you think, okay, you know, it was thrown in there to kind of pad out the list.
Well, it doesn't mention it, because biased policing can mean anything. It could mean, well, we want to make sure that it's more biased toward rich people, for example.
Yeah. We don't want to pull people over, you know, for driving while black or something. It doesn't really address the issues of the use of force or how minority suspects are treated once they're in custody. And that's one of the main issues that the Department of Justice investigated, and that led to the investigation in the first place.
The DOJ actually met privately with SPD and with the city yesterday to give their specific recommendations about what to do as follow-ups to the report, and you could bet that there is zero overlap between this list of 20 items and the DOJ recommendations, which have not been made public yet.
Yeah, I mean, very little overlap. There are some good things on here, though. I think the number one, reform management of public demonstrations, I saw that. I'm like, yeah, that'd be nice. Where are the specifics? And that's really what bothered me about this whole list, is McGinn was elected because I think a lot of people saw him as reform, somebody who would come in and make changes at City Hall that and would do things differently from the way Nichols and the downtown business association had been running things. And this is not a whole lot different from what we would have expected from someone like Greg Nichols.
I think actually the last two items on this list tell you that it's not only not different, but it's committed to maintaining the status quo. The last two items are launch a community outreach initiative and launch a customer relations initiative. In other words, we don't want to actually change any of the practices that the DOJ is criticizing us for. We're going to talk about a whole bunch of unrelated stuff in the vaguest terms possible, and then we're going to improve our spin. So, yeah. So that and we don't have to change our practices, we have to change how we sell our practices to the people who count, i.e. not the people who are being victimized by them.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about Seattle values and get all touchy-feely and stuff, and hopefully that will make this problem go away, and that is not going to happen. Getting all touchy-feely and saying nice things and pretending that there's not a problem, you know, or that you're becoming a little more sensitive, that's not going to address these very serious problems. So I really agree with the ACLU and with some of the other groups who have said that what Seattle needs is an outside mediator to come in or an outside person to come in and oversee changes at the Seattle Police Department. They should go for the court-ordered mandate and do that whole process.
Yeah, the other thing I think we can learn from this list concerns Mayor McGinn. And as Maria said, when he was elected, a lot of people elected him with the idea that he would come in and reform things and not be part of the status quo that has run Seattle for decades. Instead, he picked the choice of the old boy network, John Diaz, as the new police chief. And you could have excused that because McGinn was very new at the time. It was one of his first major decisions. But then his response, his immediate response when the DOJ came out with its report in December, was to poo-poo it. And, well, okay, that was an off-the-cuff reaction. But this tells you that really he is sticking up for and covering up for the police department and is not interested in addressing the many, many legitimate concerns that all sorts of people have raised, not just in the last few months or the last couple of years, but this has been going on for many, many years.
Yes.
It comes and goes in the media depending on whether there are high-profile cases like John T. Williams. But you talk to people in non-white communities in Seattle, and they will tell you this has been going on for decades, and it needs a comprehensive change in the culture of the department from the top, and that is not even remotely being considered in this list.
Yeah, and to be fair, it wasn't to the mayor that was totally responsible for the appointment of Diaz as police chief. The city council had some input into it as well. And I just want to point out too that come the next election, when the mayoral candidates will be running, McGinn won't be the only person who's a candidate. Almost certainly Tim Burgess, who currently sits on the city council.
Well, and who is a former policeman.
And yeah, who's a former policeman and was formerly head of the city council's committee that oversaw the police department. He bears some responsibility too. So it'll be interesting to see what happens then, if what kind of platform he runs on in terms of these issues, because he definitely also has been a part of this whole process.
All right. Moving on, Nick Licata also coming out with a proposal this week.
Yeah, Councilmember Nick Licata, who's the chair of the committee that oversees the housing for the city of Seattle, he brought up a proposal this week for rental housing inspections. And his proposal, I think, is much better than the proposal that was put forth by the city's Department of Planning and Development. They did what they called a process where they took all kinds of input from different, quote-unquote, stakeholders, meaning they talked to a lot of landlords as well as to the tenants' union and a few tenants, and came up with a proposal that can succinctly be termed drive-by inspections. Basically, the city Department of Planning and Development inspectors would go and drive by a housing unit, and if the building looked okay from the outside, they would give it an all clear and say, okay, you passed the inspection.
Whether it has running water or not.
Yeah, they wouldn't actually go inside, look at the plumbing, look and see if there were bug infestations, look and see if the wiring was safe, you know, all the things you're supposed to do when you inspect a dwelling. So Licata's proposal would have the department inspect all rental housing units over a 10-year period. the city would start with the about 7,000 properties that have three or more units, try to get them all licensed and inspected, and then gradually each year would increase the number of properties that it would inspect until about all 42,000 of the city's rental properties would be licensed and be fully inspected over the 10-year period. And I think it's way better than what the city's Department of Planning and Development came up with. We'll see how far it gets with the city council.
All right. Moving on, Tim Burgess. Also.
Yeah, Nick Licata was also key this week in stopping a proposal by Tim Burgess to limit tent cities to religious institutions. Burgess was offering that as an amendment to the city's comprehensive plan, and it was aimed squarely at tent cities, groups like Sharewheel and Nicholsville, who for many years now have been operating tent cities of the homeless, not just on the grounds of churches, but also in public spaces. Obviously, Burgess probably would want to target churches as well, except courts have ruled in the past that they can't do that. Churches have the right to do whatever they want, basically, with their property. That also would have put a hole in a specific proposal that Licata had already put forward to codify the city's approach to tent cities. And, you know, Burgess's argument is, well, this isn't provided for in the 10-year plan to end homelessness, which I believe is now in year 7, and which has not, as near as I can tell, come very close so far to ending homelessness. In fact, homelessness is getting worse with the economic downturn in Seattle. Burgess eventually withdrew the proposal because of the opposition from Licata and other members of the city council. But that pressure is going to continue, particularly as we get the mayoral election next year and the politicking around that. This, I think, Burgess, as Maria mentioned, is almost certainly running for mayor next year. And this, again, is a strategy to curry favor with the downtown business interests, who have been very vocal in their hostility to anything, really, that would accommodate the needs of the homeless.
Yeah, generally an incumbent in a race gets most of the funding, and I'm sure Tim Burgess is trying to line up the major donors even as we speak.
Yeah, okay. Moving on, Dave Reichert, Congressman Dave Reichert.
Yeah, we'll talk more about what Congress did when we get to national in a minute, but I just want to note that the House of Representatives voted for the Ryan budget this week, and it was passed almost entirely along party lines. And as folks may remember, over the past several years, as Reichert has struggled against first Darcy Berger and then Suzanne DelBene, with fairly closely contested reelection campaigns in the 8th District on the East Side, that he's gotten a lot of press from the Seattle Times and other friendly media outlets about being independent and conscience-driven and taking votes against his party and so forth. Well, now that Riker's district has been withdrawn, and it includes Kittitas County east of the Cascades and is a more conservative district and a more safe seat for him, suddenly he's not a conscience-driven independent anymore. He voted for the Ryan budget. He's taken several other votes in the last month or so that have been part of the fairly extreme Tea Party agenda. And this is probably who Dave Reichert was all along. It's just now that he's comfortable enough in his own district because of the gerrymandering of the redistricting plan. He doesn't have to worry about appearing to be independent anymore. So we get a chance to see who Dave Reichert really is finally after all these years.
All right. Moving on to national, starting with an update on pink slime.
Yeah, some good news this week. The company that makes pink slime, for folks who haven't been listening to the show much, pink slime is a beef called finely textured beef trimmings. The pink slime is a product that's made mostly from connective tissue of beef cattle, ground up into a fine slime and treated with ammonia, which gives it a pink tinge.
Someone has named their band Pink Slime,
Pink
too.
Pink Slime, I'm sure. Yes, I'm sure. Beef Products, Inc. is the company that makes Pink Slime. They have shut down. They announced this week that they would shut down three of their four plants that produce the stuff, leaving only one of them open. Of course, on the other hand, it also came out this week that the guy who owns the company Beef Products, Inc. is a major donor and fundraiser for the Mitt Romney presidential campaign.
In fact, Romney in his book even cited this guy as an American success story, which tells you a lot about the few core values that Romney does have.
Yes, or the what you might say the values that rise to the top in a system like we have.
All right. Let's move on. Speaking of values, Supreme Court hearing this week about healthcare.
Yeah, it dominated the news, the hearings this week over the healthcare reform cases in the Supreme Court. On Monday, the Supreme Court heard arguments over whether or not the court can rule on the issue. And of course, they pretty much decided in the hour or so that they debated it that, yes, the Supreme Court can. Tuesday, they heard arguments over the individual insurance mandate, and it became very, very clear that the court was split along the usual partisan lines over this issue, that the four liberal justices, Breyer, Ginsburg, Kagan, and Sotomayor, had pretty much agreed that, yes, an individual insurance mandate, the government can do that, whereas Thomas Alito and Scalia, three of the most conservative justices, were clearly against the individual mandate. Kennedy and Roberts, the other two conservative justices, asked some very critical questions of the government's lawyer trying to defend the individual mandate. So it seemed very clear to people who are watching the proceedings and listening to the proceedings that the court was probably going to rule and strike down the individual mandate. And then on Wednesday came the moment of reality. You know, what could be salvaged from the healthcare reform bill if you strike down the individual insurance mandate? That kind of made it clear to everybody that if you strike down the individual insurance mandate, all these other great things that people love, that people really like about the healthcare reform bill are going to suffer.
They're not going to be practical.
That they're probably going to have to be ditched as well. And then, of course, the last thing that the court heard on Wednesday was the suit by some of the states against the federal government regarding the expansion of Medicaid, saying that was oppressive. And what was interesting about that part of the hearings was that it was very clear that the Supreme Court justices, most Supreme Court justices, were not going to go with that argument. They found that ridiculous, and I find that pretty ridiculous too. But I have a quote from Elena Kagan that summed it up. She said, quote, "It's just a boatload of federal money for you to take and spend on poor people's health care. It doesn't sound coercive to me, I have to tell you." And that's true. You know, it isn't coercive.
Especially since the states can refuse the money.
Yes, and the states have been taking federal money to cover health care for poor people and for various other purposes, you know, for decades, you know.
Yeah, the idea is what the federal government is doing is if you take our money, you have to adhere by these guidelines. And that's supposedly oppressive. Although I have to say that if somebody pays me money to do a task, I generally think that they have a right to tell me how they want the task done.
Yeah, yeah. And really what it pointed out to me when it came down to that last hearing was, okay, this is the mistake. And I've said this before, this is the mistake that Congress made by trying to expand the private insurance market to cover everybody. They made a wrong move. They needed to go single payer and expand Medicaid to cover everybody, because clearly that would have flown through a Supreme Court challenge without any problem.
Although, to be fair, I think most legal experts before this case thought that this was a no-brainer also, because
yeah,
there's plenty of precedent for the federal government having these kind of programs. But this brings us to a couple things. Number one, a caveat about this week. You don't always know how the Supreme Court is going to rule based upon the questions that the justices ask.
You don't always know.
That said, this Supreme Court, and particularly the conservative justices on the Supreme Court, have a history of grossly disregarding precedent precedent in order to impose their ideological preferences.
Yeah.
And if that's what happens again this time, it's going to be very, very difficult to have any kind of comprehensive health care reform, because as long as the Republican Party is ideologically opposed to it and has the capacity to block it in Congress, you're not going to get single payer and you're not going to get universal health care of any kind.
Yeah. And, you know, and I just want to point out, too, that in countries where they have single payer health care run by the government, that the private insurance market exists there, that there will always be people with enough money and with enough concern that they want additional coverage. And private insurance wouldn't go away if we expanded Medicaid to cover all Americans.
All right. Moving on, the EPA.
Yeah, this week the EPA announced their released their new guidelines, their new limits for greenhouse gas emissions for new power plants. The draft rule was released on Tuesday. It would limit emissions from new plants to just 1,000 pounds per megawatt hour. So natural gas plants can easily meet those standards, but coal-fired power plants would have a very, very tough time. Now, of course, these emissions rules apply only to new plants that will be built from this day forward. They won't apply to existing coal-fired power plants, which is why environmentalists have been pretty critical of the rules, saying that, look, if you really are going to get serious about regulating greenhouse gas emissions, you got to regulate what's being put out there right now instead of just looking ahead to the future. In fact, because these rules are a response to the Supreme Court decision saying that, yes, the EPA and the government must regulate greenhouse gas emissions the same way they regulate other pollutants. They must treat them like pollutants and regulate them. Environmentalists are saying this really doesn't address that ruling. And I have to say I agree with them.
All right. Moving on, the updates on the Trayvon Martin case.
Yeah, the Trayvon Martin case really blew up this week. And the reason it did, when it hadn't particularly been an ideologically driven case before this, is last weekend President Obama came out and gave a pretty measured and really a pretty harmless statement expressing concern about the case and hoping the investigation would move forward. And he said something, if I had a son, it would look like Trevor. Well, suddenly what had been a national story, but a national story of, you know, an unfortunate situation, an unfortunate local situation, suddenly became an ideological litmus test. And so you had an effort on the right all of a sudden, because President Obama had expressed concern and sympathy for the case, to bring the reputation of the teenager who was shot in Sanford, Florida, into disrepute. You had leaks from the Sanford Police Department about his history as a student in Florida, which were totally inappropriate as well as being irrelevant. You had criticism. Basically, the right saw it as an opportunity to remind people that President Obama is black. And
no discussion at all of the sort of vigilante style of the killing. It's like, why do you have these guys running around who are not members of the police department, policing a neighborhood, carrying weapons with them?
Yeah, and there have also been very serious concerns raised about the behavior of the police and the prosecutors in this case,
yeah.
Both at the local level and at the state level. The Department of Justice is looking into this, and
as it should,
as it should. But at the same time, you have other stories, a couple in New York State this week of black teenagers either disappearing or in one case in the Bronx being an unarmed black kid who was shot by the police get national attention.
In his own home.
These cases go on all the time.
Yeah, and this is everywhere.
This is a reminder that this is an endemic problem in American culture and American society, and it needs to. And again, as with the SPD reforms that are needed here in Seattle, this is a discussion that needs to be happening all over the country.
Yes.
All right, Congress.
Yeah, we had several things going on in Congress this week. The Senate considering and failing with only 51 votes, which is a majority, but it wasn't enough to head off a Republican filibuster on a bill to repeal government subsidies for big oil companies. You probably won't find a lot of politicians who will get up there and say, yes, ExxonMobil and Chevron and Shell really need hundreds of millions and billions of dollars worth of federal subsidies every year because their profits are so marginal and it's such a difficult industry to make any money in. But that's the, and oh yes, because we really don't need to balance the budget. But that's the argument that's being made, basically. And again, 49 senators, 46 of them Republicans, and then three Democrats from oil producing states, all voted in favor of this, which is pretty darn depressing. The House, as I mentioned earlier, passed the Paul Ryan budget, which is a DOA in the Senate, and the White House, but, it is an expression that, an awful lot of people in the House of Representatives, want to starve your granny, for starters, and also can't do basic math. They also waited until Thursday to pass a highway funding bill whose funding in terms of federal transportation funding expired today. And the reason for this is it didn't leave the Senate any time to pass a similar bill before they had to pass something in order to salvage the funding. And so what the House bill did is it took out a number of transportation related jobs. So by playing politics and not allowing the Senate to pass its own bill, the Republicans in the House killed thousands of jobs that not only would have helped the transportation in this country, but also could have helped stimulate the economy. Remember that the next time you hear Republicans talking about the need to improve the economy.
Okay. And quickly, court ruling dealing with Catholic bishops?
Yeah, the U.S. District Court for the District of Massachusetts ruled against the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops lawsuit against the Obama administration this week. And it really was a court validation of the Obama administration's change in contraception policy earlier this year. The lawsuit the Catholic bishops said that the Obama administration had abridged their religious freedom by canceling their contract because the Catholic bishops were imposing their religious standards on the contracts for the hospitals that they were running and using a federal contract for health care. Now, it helps to understand what this particular contract was. The contract with the Catholic hospitals was to provide health care for rescued victims of sex slavery. And what happened was the Catholic hospitals were refusing to provide abortions or contraception. Now, if you can possibly come up with a population or a class of people more desperately in need of contraception and reproductive health in general, I would have to imagine it would be if you could find one that is more appropriate than rescued sex slaves, I can't imagine what it is. And it really gets down to the whole idea of how important it is not to have religious beliefs impinging on basic health care.
Yeah, and it really kind of points to this thing about here the government, our government, gives enormous tax breaks to religious organizations so that they can take the money, they can keep the money that they collect and use it to, you know, build infrastructure that the government really should be providing, like hospitals and healthcare, to in areas that don't have that infrastructure. And this is the problem with that, is that when you allow religious organizations to step in and take the role of the government, they bring in their ideology with them, and then you get these conflicts.
Yeah. And the contract was also originally came out of the President Bush's faith-based initiatives, and that tells you what that was all about, mm-hmm. too.
Yeah.
All right. Nope. Okay. How about events?
We have one event coming up this week on April 5th, this Thursday. Seattle Central and the other colleges in the Seattle Community College Network, there's going to be a public hearing consider a gross abridgment of rights for a public protest on community college campuses around Seattle. The hearing on that is going to be held at the Seattle Community College District offices at 1500 Harvard Avenue on Capitol Hill, right across the street from Seattle Central. That will be on Thursday from 3 to 5 p.m. in the first floor boardroom, 1500 Harvard Avenue East. The bigger the turnout, the better. The one other event that was also coming up on Thursday the 5th has been canceled, and that is civil rights blogger and author Glenn Greenwald was supposed to be appearing at Kane Hall. That event, unfortunately, has been canceled.
Yeah, we're all looking forward to that. Okay. Talking, as we do every week, with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org.
And some of my work can be found on my website at mariatomchick.com.